This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. In 1974, the Nixon administration unveiled Project Independence, a plan to make the U.S. energy independent. The idea has been with us ever since. Both Barack Obama and John McCain list energy independence as a top priority. Can the U.S. achieve energy independence? Should it pursue such a goal? Journalist Robert Bryce says the idea of energy independence is, quote, hogwash, and, quoting again, a prized bit of meaningful-sounding rhetoric that can be tossed out by candidates and political operatives eager to appeal to the broadest cross-section of voters. Bryce, managing editor of Energy Tribune and a contributing writer at the Texas Observer, says the U.S. needs to accept the reality of energy interdependence. Robert Bryce, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence, is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments for our guest, Robert Bryce, are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Robert Bryce has been writing about energy for nearly two decades now. His work has appeared in many publications. His book, Gusher of Lies, is his third. His first book, Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron, was published in 2002. His second, Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate, was published in 2004. The new book, Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence, is published by Public Affairs Books. And you'll find our guest on the website, www.robertbryce.com. Bryce spelled B-R-Y. CE. Again, those phone numbers 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Robert Bryce, thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on, Celeste.
My pleasure. Well, here we are in June of 2008, and I'm seeing headlines that suggest we're headed for $5 a gallon gasoline. Do you think that's where we're headed?
Ooh, gee, you know, Celeste, if I could predict gasoline prices or oil prices, I'd be so rich, I'd make Bill Gates look like a pauper. But
and I'd try to shadow you.
And I'd give you the stock tip. You know, there is a whole lot of demand globally, and that is one of the key issues here. I wrote a piece just recently pointing out that in 2007, according to the Energy Information Administration, demand exceeded supply by 760,000 barrels a day. And if you look at the recent figures out of China, where the refined product demand in the first quarter went up 16.5%, and look at the fact that there's very little spare production capacity globally, and it seems that this demand for oil is continuing apace, and we're just not finding and producing enough fast enough to bring prices down.
Have we yet seen a slowing in demand?
Well, we are seeing it here in the U.S. already. Earlier this year, the Energy Information Administration estimated that gasoline demand in the U.S. will drop 2 percentage points or more this year, which is the first drop in demand in nearly two decades. So high prices are clearly having an effect, and they're clearly hurting a lot of people. But as I've said many times, the only thing that is going to reduce our oil consumption and or force us to use alternatives, whether they're electric cars or natural gas vehicles or whatever, are high prices. And we're certainly getting a stiff dose of that.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that you point out in your book, Gusher of Lies, is that the poorest people, you know, here in the United States and across the world are those most affected, most hurt by the situation.
Well, that's true. And while there's no question that it's hurting lower-income people in America, the ones that are going to feel the sharpest effects of higher energy prices are the residents in the poorest countries globally. So people in Pakistan, India, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Afghanistan, you can name these countries as well as I, they will have far less purchasing power than the average American in terms of increasing their ability to buy oil and refined products. So, yes, this is bad for consumers all over the world, not just here in the U.S.
Mm. We have a caller already waiting to talk with you this afternoon, so let's go and take this call. Listener on line 4, good afternoon. You're on the air with Robert Bryce.
Hey, good afternoon. I have family in the oil business, okay, and they're a small jobber. It's not very big, but everybody likes to give them a bad time. I'm not in it. I'm one of the fortunate ones. I didn't want to be a part of it because I saw this coming down the pipe 30 years ago. But the problem I seem to see in this country, just this country alone, is the environmentalists seem to hold us at bay. I mean, it's a small group of people. To me, I can't understand why we can't do both drilling and try to at least alleviate some of the problem. And with refining, I know it's going to take, you know, some time to do this, but at the same time, allow people to develop other forms of transportation. And the reason I say this is because if you basically bankrupt the nation, who is going to have the money to invest in or produce vehicles? Because right now, the ones I know that have the knowledge behind it are struggling because of that fact. Just to get product to and from one point, from point A to point B, will be very difficult, along with a few other things. People forget, too, the crude oil is only a small drop in a bucket. I've got a diagram at home that shows that it's a small percentage of what comes out of a 44-gallon drum of oil. And, you know, I can't see forcing the issue. You bankrupt the nation in order to make something happen like this? No, I think what you ought to do is give companies incentives to do something. I mean, it's like taxing a company for doing good.
Sure.
I just don't understand it.
Okay,
well, I'll address a couple of points you made. There's no question in my mind that we need to increase domestic oil and gas production. We're seeing that in the natural gas side, and I'm very bullish on using more natural gas in the transportation sector. I'm a big believer in natural gas vehicles. Last year alone in the U.S., natural gas production increased 3.2%. That was four times faster than the production growth rate seen in Canada. Meanwhile, Russia, has the single biggest natural gas reserves on the planet, their natural gas production actually fell by half a percentage point. So we're seeing increased natural gas production. We're not seeing the same kind of response in oil production, and that is in part a factor, the fact that so much of the domestic oil reserves are off limits. And I'm not just speaking about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. I'm particularly pointing to the eastern Gulf of Mexico. I believe we need to drill in Anwar. We should have started yesterday, but the day before yesterday, we should have started drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, which continues to be locked off to oil and gas exploration, even though it contains 3 billion barrels of oil and about 20 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. So you mentioned a lot of things, but I think that clearly we need to be serious about increasing our domestic production, and Congress instead has prohibited that, and in fact, idiotically passed a bill just a couple of weeks ago saying the House wanted to sue OPEC for not producing enough oil and gas. It's crazy.
Yeah, let's have a quick follow-up from the caller in Peru. Good afternoon. Go ahead.
Yes. No, I just wanted to add one other thing. I have a four-year degree in forestry, and this is what and I solely believe the whole thing, the problem, the situation being with what we have here now, is because of the environmental issues, and the reason being is if you look at the forests in the Northwest, used to be in the 70s and early 80s, we used to do controlled burning over there to stop and eradicate bugs out and clear cut or not clear cut but clear out some of the brush, underlying brush, to try and adhere or try to stop some of this invasive species. Now what has happened is 2/3 of the forests are getting wiped out by a bark beetle, and it's spreading throughout the whole country now, not just there, and even in some parts of the Midwest. And it's solely attributed because we can't control burn anymore because the environmentalists say it's polluting the environment. So there goes the lumber industry completely. There goes a lot of jobs that people had up there. Plus, if you the way that everything's being urbanized, I'm just using this.
Okay, let me hop in here and let's raise the issue of environmentalism. Is it part of the problem?
Well, look, I'm all for, and I have solar panels on the roof of my house. I'm all for renewables. I'm all for alternatives. And as I point out in my book, solar and wind are great, but the problem is they're constrained by their ability to provide baseload power in the electric sector. We can't also, our demand is for liquid fuels in the transportation sector. So, some of this is obviously constraints by environmental the environmental lobby. There's no question about that. ANWR has become a litmus test among the Democrats in particular. So, we cannot blame all of the rise in gasoline prices and natural gas prices and diesel prices on the environmentalists. This is a global issue. What we are seeing is a global increase in demand for all kinds of commodities, not just oil, copper, crude oil, nickel, aluminum, building materials, you name it. And as the world gains in wealth, then consumption increases. And so this is part of a broader cycle. It's not just about environmentalism here in the U.S.
At the same time, though, we should be pursuing alternative and renewable sources of energy, and we should be conserving energy?
Well, of course, and we are doing that. Celeste, I just finished an essay where I point out the Manhattan Project is underway. We have a lot of pundits and politicos saying, well, the U.S. needs to launch a Manhattan Project to find the next thing in whatever it is, in batteries or in solar energy or whatever, where we can reduce our use of fossil fuels. I'm all for it. I think that's great. But remember, one, this is not a new effort. People have been trying to find alternatives to oil ever since we've been using oil. They haven't found any yet, and I hope they do. Good luck to them. But last year alone, according to New Energy Finance, a London-based research firm, global firms spent nearly $150 billion on what they call clean tech and clean energy technologies. That's a fourfold increase in just the last 4 years. So these investments are being made. Don't believe they aren't. And as they become economic and more viable, they will gain traction in the marketplace.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Robert Bryce, author most recently of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Listeners, if you'd like to talk with us, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Spring Bay, line one. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I get a little uptight when I start hearing people say we need to start drilling in ANWR now when we don't have a very responsible energy policy in place. The way I look at ANWR and the Eastern Gulf is that's the legacy for the next generation, for our kids or grandkids, and they're going to have to come up with some way of creating a post-carbon, post-oil economy. And if we drill that now and burn it up with, irresponsible energy policies, we're going to really, limit their options in the future. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I understand your point. I just also am of the opinion that we are finding more and more oil and gas all the time. I understand this idea about preserving it for future generations. That's fine. But I also understand the needs of the global marketplace now. And we have these resources, and I think George Will wrote in his column the other day something to the effect of, don't kid yourself that we don't have an energy policy. We do. Our energy policy in America is, don't drill here, force OPEC to drill over there. So your other point on moving to a post-carbon energy economy, look, again, I'm all for that, but the problem is always going to be energy density, cost, and scale. And again, we are not going to move toward lower carbon or no carbon fuels unless or until they become cheaper, cleaner, more convenient than the fuels we're using now. So unless or until that happens, we're going to continue using what we have because they are so efficient and they are so energy dense, and they give us the kinds of services, whether it's transportation, air conditioning, whatever, that we need.
You say we're going to be stuck with the system that we have for the next 3 to 5 decades. What do you see out there on that horizon 30, 40, 50 years down the line?
Well, I think some of these things are already happening, Celeste, and it's a trend that I talk about in the book. It's called decarbonization. The market is moving toward cleaner fuels. More specifically, it's moving toward natural gas. It is, I think, slowly also adopting more nuclear power, which is, of course, lower no carbon. But this trend toward fuels like natural gas that contain less carbon and away from fuels like coal that are high carbon, 40 times, well, not 40 times, 16 times more carbon content than methane or natural gas, that's a positive trend. And it's a positive trend regardless of your feelings about peak oil or global warming. And that is, we're finding more natural gas globally than we are oil. And with regard to greenhouse gases, natural gas emits half as much CO2 when it's burned as coal does. So we're moving toward that. But I think the other point that I make in the book is we need super batteries. Batteries are the technology kind of holy grail that inventors have been pursuing since Edison's day. Edison spent a decade of his some $30 million of his own money trying to build high-density batteries. He improved them, but he didn't get the kind of density that we really need, and we have researchers doing that today. So those are the really promising things that I can see happening over the next 3 to 5 decades. As we move more toward natural gas, we use more batteries, and then that makes solar and wind more viable, and I think inevitably it's going to be nuclear power as well.
Mm. Was the call at the outset in 1974 for energy independence meant as a realistic call to action, or was it rhetoric right from the get-go meant to give us a psychological or emotional boost?
Well, you know, that would require psychological analysis of Richard Nixon, which I think has been done many times. And, of course, I'm happy to delve into that as much as anybody else. But I think it was partly a psychological thing, there's no question. Whether Nixon actually believed we could achieve energy independence, I can't say. But is a phrase that has endured in American politics for now for 3.5 decades because it is so appealing. And as I say in the book, I think that its appeal comes from several different factors, all of which contribute to this free-floating anxiety in the U.S. And those four factors, I think, are peak oil, global warming, terrorism, and the second Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
All of those, I think, all these issues about energy come together and make people uneasy and worried about the future. Are we going to have enough oil? Is the planet going to burn up? Are we going to be in Iraq for the next 10 or 20 years, as John McCain has said, or the 100 years? I've forgotten what his exact quote was. All of these things make us uneasy because they're inevitably tied to oil and energy consumption. So I think that's why this phrase has endured, and as I point out in the book, we need to discard it, and we need to accept the fact that we are interdependent, and it's not just about crude oil and gasoline and jet fuel. It's iPods, bottled water, beer, fresh flowers, you name it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thinking back to the 70s, the mid-70s. One wonders if the OPEC oil embargo of that time should have illustrated to us that the world's economies are energy interdependent.
Well, you make a good point, and it should have. And in fact, when you look back at that time period and the embargo, the oil-producing countries recognized that the embargo was a failure, that, in fact, the U.S. wasn't denied oil, and nor was the Netherlands, or the two countries that were the targets of the embargo. And, in fact, among the more interesting graphics I have in the book is one that shows that, in fact, between 1972, 73, 74, oil imports over that time period continued to rise. So even as the U.S. was facing an embargo, our imported oil volumes kept increasing, which again shows, I think, that the embargo didn't work. So I think it could have served as a wake-up call, and there were some discussions in the Nixon administration about imposing a gasoline tax to force the economy to become more efficient in terms of liquid fuels, but Nixon and the Republicans were opposed to it, and essentially every presidential administration and every Congress since then has also opposed it because Americans don't want to pay higher prices at the pump.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Robert Bryce, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing? I have two questions for you, I guess, because I remember the gas lines in California. And I think one of the problems that happens with these energy situations is sometimes they are manufactured. So that's my first question to you. The fact that we're paying $4 a gallon may not be necessary, nor may it be real when all is said and done, but we won't know that until it shakes out. And I don't know that people in the Midwest had the opportunity to sit in lines for hours and hours by license plate numbers and that kind of thing. And then I guess my second question is, why are we so fearful of the conservation work? You know, I got people even here in Champaign and Urbana into the idea of just saying, instead of picking up boxes of paper to take to your office, why not have a truck deliver them? What's so hard with that? And why are we so opposed to that kind of concept, I suppose, is what I'm asking you. And I'll hang up and listen for your answer. And thanks okay. for the discussion.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'll take your second part of the question first, in that I understand the arguments about conservation. I'm just not sure it means different things to different people, I guess, is my first response. And second, I'm all for conservation. I'm all for efficiency. And I think those are, obviously, those are positive things for the economy. They're positive things for consumers. That said, engineers are always seeking more efficiency from their machinery, whatever it is, whether it's computers for higher bandwidth, higher throughput, and so on. But be careful here, because efficiency, greater efficiency, and this is one of the great paradoxes of energy research, and one that is poorly understood, but it is that energy efficiency doesn't necessarily mean lower energy consumption. This is known as the Jevons paradox, which was named after a British economist named William Stanley Jevons in 1865, published a book called The Coal Question, and the Jevons paradox says energy consumption or energy efficiency doesn't necessarily lower consumption. In fact, it probably increases it. And there have been numerous studies that have found that very result. Your first question was, is this a manufactured shortage? There's a lot of discussion today about is the fact that we're at oil at $130, is that a factor, is that really being driven by speculators in the market? I've seen convincing numbers that say, in fact, that it's not. And the smartest people that I've talked to in the energy sector are saying, no, that this is really about a fundamentals question. Regarding the gas lines, I have a section in Gusher of Lies in which I talk about the gasoline shortages during the 1970s. Those were largely a result of government interference in the marketplace. They were about price controls imposed by Congress and the White House, not crude oil shortages. I'll say it again because, again, this is a great misconception. The Arab oil embargo is blamed for the gas lines, and it is blamed wrongly. The price controls that were imposed during the Nixon administration and continued through until they were repealed by the Reagan administration were largely responsible for the shortages of gasoline. And, in fact, we had shortages of gasoline before the Arab oil embargo in 1973.
In the section of the book about you know, why energy independence has had such traction and why it continues, you include an excerpt from a memo, a 2006 memo from Democrat strategist James Carville.
Sure.
Stating energy independence, quoting here, is the one issue that gives people hope we can be more secure, get beyond Iraq, and also have a stronger economy that creates American jobs. That's really telling. And then I'm thinking about the subtitle of your book, Dangerous Delusions. What are the dangerous delusions? What does the idea of energy independence cost us?
Well, I think it costs us this idea that we don't have to be engaged with the rest of the world. let me give you just a couple of numbers that I just looked up recently. They aren't in the book because they just came out. Last year, the United States imported oil or oil products from 90 different countries. We exported, and this is a little-known fact, the U.S. exported an average of 1.4 million barrels of oil per day in 2007 to customers in 73 countries. Again, the point here is the delusion is this idea, and the dangerous delusion is this idea that we can isolate ourselves from the rest of the global economy. It is a dangerous delusion because the world is growing more interdependent every day in every kind of commodity, whether that commodity is intellectual capital that American companies partnering with Indian companies for customer service, or whether you like that or not, it is a fact of life. The globalization of commodities of all kinds, whether those are iPods or computers or semiconductor chips or whatever. The idea that we can isolate ourselves, the U.S. is the single biggest energy consumer in the world, can isolate itself from the single biggest sector in the global economy, the $5 trillion a year energy business, is just ludicrous on its face. And it's a dangerous delusion because the U.S. needs to be embracing this idea of globalism and open borders and open markets, and instead we're having this discussion which is isolationist in terms of energy policy, and I think that's dangerous.
Yeah. One of the surprises for me in Gusher of Lies was that we import electricity from Mexico.
And from Canada.
And from Canada. Well, Canada, to me, not so surprising somehow or other, but Mexico, that surprised me.
Well, and again, it's because in certain areas, it just makes sense for local communities along the border to have interconnections with Mexico rather than power plants that are, say, further north in the U.S., that it's not economic to ship the power all the way down to their location. What I thought was, I agree with you, it is somewhat surprising. It's also somewhat surprising to me that some utilities in the eastern U.S. are importing coal from Colombia. Here is the U.S., the Saudi Arabia of coal, and yet they're importing coal from foreign countries because it simply makes economic sense for them to bring that coal. In many cases, it's lower sulfur content, therefore it's cleaner, and they can burn it in their power plants and not have the acid rain effects and so on. It just makes economic sense. So the market is going to always seek the lowest cost provider, whether it's in electricity or coal or tennis shoes or whatever. And we need to accept that fact.
So we've got a really sophisticated and, pardon the pun, well-oiled global market.
We do. And I think that there's no more integrated, nor is there a more transparent market right now, I think, than the global oil market, where virtually anyone at any time can find out what the price of oil is. Try doing that for and that's the wholesale price. Try doing that for iPods or a case of beer. You know, what's the retail price or the wholesale price of a case of Heineken in Amsterdam? I don't know.
One of the things you take on in this book is ethanol. Chapter 12 is titled The Ethanol Scam. What's wrong with ethanol?
Well, now, I know it's not going to win me many votes in Illinois where I'm running for office, but the fact is that this is fiscal insanity. We're making subsidized motor fuel out of the single most subsidized crop in America, and that's corn. This idea that corn ethanol is going to somehow make a big impact on our oil consumption or increase our energy security or reduce our oil imports is just a fraud. It is a fraud that's been perpetrated on American taxpayers by the congressional delegations from the farm states, Illinois been among them, that if only we produced more corn ethanol, somehow we're going to buy less oil from the Saudis or the Kuwaitis or who, you know, you name the country that you don't like. It's just simply not true. Even if the U.S. converted all of the corn grown in America into ethanol, it would only provide 6% of America's oil needs. And then what do we have to eat? If we converted all the soybeans grown in America into biodiesel, it would provide 1.5% of America's oil needs. We cannot grow our way, and by that I mean farmers growing our way, into energy independence or anything close to it.
Mm. So are policymakers true believers, or do they see what it means politically?
You know, I talked to a fellow this morning that he made a good point. He said, we don't have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We have two populist parties. I never thought of it that way, but I think there's some truth in that politicians are going to say what sounds good. And so, thus, you have the House voting by a margin of 370 to 75 or something the week before last, approving a bill that would allow the Justice Department to sue OPEC because they're not drilling enough. Now, on the face of this, this is idiotic. How are we going to force them to do anything they want? They're sovereign countries. But it is about populism that Congress and the politicos and other people who hate big oil or hate the energy company of their choice, they just want to stand up and say, well, they're bad, and let's go after them. And so it's all about populism and nothing, and totally disregards the facts. And so my book was written, and I think very carefully footnoted when I have a citation saying, here are the facts. If you don't, you can agree or disagree with my conclusions, but you can't. You got to have. You got to bring some other facts to the table, and so that's what I tried to do with this book.
Yeah, maybe you'd give us an idea. This is another interesting factoid from the book. The General Accounting Office, the GAO, in 2007 said corn-based ethanol is more expensive to produce than gasoline. Why? Give us a little primer here about what is involved in getting a gallon of ethanol produced.
Sure. Well, let me just give you a quick primer first on the issues of thermodynamics. And this is the one that it's, I'm no expert on science, but I really had to acquaint myself with physics a little bit to try and understand what's going on. The first law of thermodynamics says energy is neither created nor destroyed. The second law says that energy tends toward randomness, that you can't increase the energy in a system because the energy tends to run out. So with a field of corn, or in a, even a, let's take a wind turbine, for example. Start with a wind turbine. You have a very disparate form of energy. That is the kinetic energy of the wind, and you want to concentrate it and turn it into electricity. Well, you have to have a really big windmill to be able to do that, and that takes effort. You've got to put it up. You've got to manufacture the blades and so on. With a field of corn, you need a tractor. You need a farmer. You need the seed. You need the fertilizer. You need the water. All of these elements have to come together to produce the kernels of corn. Then you have to harvest them, again, taking more energy. Then you have to truck them to the ethanol plant, and then they have to boil them, they have to distill them. All of those processes take energy. And each time you have a step in that process, you're adding energy into the process. So that at the end of that process, and there are many studies that have been done on this, ultimately you have about one BTU input for one BTU output of ethanol. In other words, you're fighting uphill the whole way to derive concentrated energy from disparate forms of energy. That is, the kernels of corn or the stalks of grass in the field. You're trying to distill them and make them into a concentrated form of energy, and that takes a lot of energy. Whereas with crude oil, you're starting with an energy form that is highly concentrated, has a very high BTU content on a weight basis or a volume basis, and you're converting it into another form that is also very high energy. So you're starting with a high energy product and ending with a high energy product. With ethanol, you're starting with a very low energy feedstock to create a higher energy result. So I think that's about the best I can explain it.
Okay. Robert Bryce is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Interesting show you have today. I'm curious, though, when I hear the arguments about ethanol, I always hear about corn, and I hear about beans, which are, I have to agree, it's silly to try to take our food crops and make them into our energy crops as well. What bothers me is that it seems that there's cellulosic biodiesel. There's a plant on the Gulf Coast right now that, it's my understanding, is creating fuel from that is with the energy ratio that your guest was describing. Not only is it running on par with that, but its waste is usable. I think it's feedstock. I could be wrong about that. The second one is algae, which is being used as jet fuel. And that one really, I think I'm excited about. The third one then was another plant. I think it starts with a J. Maybe you're calling, or you're, I'm sure.
Caller is breaking up on us there, so but there's a number of interesting points that he raised there.
Sure. Well, I think the more important one there, Celeste, was the algae idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not bullish on cellulosic ethanol for all of the reasons I just ran through in terms of corn, because the best analogy I can think of with cellulosic ethanol is, imagine, I'm 47. When I was a kid, I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and my mom had us bag the grass. When we cut the grass, we had to have a bag on it. Well, what cellulosic ethanol is trying to do is take your lawnmower and somehow take a hose from your lawnmower and put it right into your car. I mean, that's essentially the analogy. The idea that you're going to be able to turn grass clippings or switchgrass or whatever the feedstock is into something that you're going to fuel your car with. That, to me, is conceptually a lot harder than turning corn into motor fuel. But anyway, I'll set that analogy aside, perfect or imperfect as it may be. Algae is a more interesting feedstock as a potential provider of diesel fuel or jet fuel or other hydrocarbons, because it doesn't require as much space and because it can be developed or grown in a number of areas that don't require huge fertilizer inputs. So I'm fairly bullish on algae as a potential producer of lipids, and which then can be turned into hydrocarbons or hydrocarbon facsimiles. But again, it's always going to be about cost and scale, and a lot of these algae producers are producing on the bench or in very small volumes. It just remains to be seen whether they can scale up to the kind of scale that we really need them to achieve.
Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka on line 4. Good afternoon. Line 4? Let me ask my technical director. Can we go to line 4, Henry? Okay, there we go. Eureka, do we have you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I offer an answer that is not popular, but I think it's most immediately achievable, and that is highly concentrated conservation, such as lowering the national speed limit to 60 miles an hour, encouraging carpooling, especially in urban areas, massively extending mass transit, because I think that would produce dramatic results, especially since, as you noted, our country uses one quarter of the oil in the world, and our per capita energy use, I believe, is twice as high as Europe or Japan. But we don't seem to want to do it because it would require something of us.
Well, fair enough. I think that a friend of mine, Ed Wallace, who's a writer in Fort Worth, has talked about this idea of a national speed limit of 60 miles an hour. He proposed it in a column. I don't know whether he wrote it for the Star-Telegram or for Business Week, but he said he got more hate mail on that one column than anything he'd ever written. Mm-hmm. So one man's conservation is another man's robbing of his liberty. So there's no question that lowering the speed limit could have an effect. Is it politically viable? I have my doubts. To me, it sounds akin to the carbon tax in terms of people saying, oh, well, we can't have that.
Well, it's something everyone could do. It would require something of everyone. It's not asking us to cut off your arm. Maybe it would take 10 more minutes to get to work. Maybe it would be a little bit more inconvenience, but it would seem to be there would be immediately achievable goals that everyone could at least participate in.
Sure. I agree with you. I think that it's a sound idea, but how politically popular it would be, I can't answer. The issue of conservation, I agree with you, and I think that what we're seeing is the beginning of a lot of that. As these at $4 gasoline, people are being motivated to change their habits, and I think
Yes. We're
starting to see that. But as I've said a couple times already, I think the only things that are going to make us or finally force us to move to something other than the fossil fuels that we've been using is when something else comes along that can compete with it on price.
But whether
those alternatives come down to meet the price of $130 or whether the price of oil has to go to higher point, whether it's $200, $300, I don't know the number, to make those other alternatives and renewables viable, I can't answer.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana and online at will.illinois.edu. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Clark County and east central Illinois until 2:15 this afternoon. At 1:43, National Weather Service meteorologists detected a severe thunderstorm capable of producing quarter-size hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles per hour. The storm, located 4 miles north of West Union, or about 9 miles south of Marshall, moving northeast at 37 miles per hour. Severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Clark County and east central Illinois. Meanwhile, we have a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of east central, south central, and southeastern Illinois in effect until 7 p.m. this evening, and a flash flood watch in effect through Tuesday morning for the northern two-thirds of Illinois and central Indiana. Back to that severe thunderstorm watch in the AM 580 severe weather coverage area. The watch includes Clark, Cumberland, and Edgar counties. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program, journalist Robert Bryce, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Let's take one more call this afternoon. Listener in Bloomington, Illinois, line two. Hi.
Hi. I spent 30 years in Tulsa. It's a great city.
Well, thank you. I was just there over the weekend.
Yeah, I loved it. I graduated from TU. So, big oil country.
Yes.
I don't know if it's coming back. But anyway, I got a little tired of seeing these cartoons of ethanol, containers of ethanol tied to a starving person. And I then recently, I'm sure you're familiar with these articles, with the exposure that Governor Grassley or Senator Grassley from Iowa exposed the Grocery Manufacturers Association contract with a PR firm. I think it's Glover Park. To undermine the whole ethanol and idea and promote the new thought that it's ethanol that's causing starving children and food prices to go up and so forth. You're familiar with that, I'm sure.
Well, I've written about the issue of food pricing and ethanol, and I think that the connection has been made by a number of different on a number of different studies. One was done by Iowa State University, which came out last May, that said that the ethanol mandates are costing every American something on the order of $47 in the form of higher food prices. Now, you can argue with Iowa State's numbers, but I'd hardly call them the province of big oil or the handmaidens of the fossil fuel industry.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. Before we wrap up, one last question. What are your thoughts about how automakers are dealing with the current situation, both those here in the U.S. and those elsewhere in the world?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that it's the one that, clearly, transportation uses 60% of our oil or more. Two-thirds of our oil is used for transportation, whether it's in airplanes or in cars. So the automakers have a big role here. I'm a big believer in natural gas vehicles. They're the part of the discussion that is really being ignored now as we talk about ethanol and so on. We import 20% of our natural gas. We import 60% of our oil. So I would really like to see the automakers producing more natural gas vehicles and having the federal government promoting them more, because I think it makes a whole lot of sense. Interestingly enough, just a brief aside, 2 months ago I was talking to an engineer from Toyota who was talking about natural gas as the natural fuel for the fuel cell of the future, where they would put reformers at a service station and convert natural gas to hydrogen right there at the service station and then pump the hydrogen directly into your car. So I think the automakers are clearly very concerned, and they're very involved in trying to figure out where the global oil market and global energy market is going, because they have many tens of billions of dollars riding on the outcome. So we need them to be more active. Whether it's going to be electric cars, natural gas vehicles, I think it's likely going to be a combination of all of them.
Okay, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Robert Bryce, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a million, Celeste.
Robert Bryce is the author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. He's a journalist. He's managing editor of Energy Tribune and a contributing writer at the Texas Observer. His book, Gusher of Lies, is his third book. It is published by Public Affairs Books.